Good afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Gil Klein. I'm the club's president and a national correspondent for Media General Newspapers, writing for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Tampa Tribune, and the Winston-Salem Journal. I'd like to welcome the club members in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching us on C-SPAN or listening to us on National Public Radio or the Internet Global Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of some upcoming events. On Monday, June 6, former President Gerald Ford will present the Ford Foundation Journalism Awards and talk about the challenge to America. On Tuesday, June 7, Norman Augustine, Chairman and CEO of the Martin Marietta Company, will discuss the defense industry in a speech entitled, "Headed for High Noon Again, the Future of the U.S. Defense Industry." And on Wednesday, June 8, Herbert Kelleher, Chairman of the Board and President and CEO of Southwest Airlines, will present a speech entitled, "My Life as an Airline Commissioner." Also, I'd like to mention that there will be a book and author wrap on Wednesday, June 1st, starting at 6 p.m., with Harry Jaffe and Tom Sherwood, authors of Dream City, Race, Power, and the Decline of Washington, D.C. Transcripts, audio, and videotapes of today's lunch are available by calling 1-800-500-9911. If you have any questions for our speaker, and I certainly trust that you will, please write them on the cards provided for you at the tables. That's right, pick them right up, pass them around, and send them up here, and I will ask as many as time permits. I'd like now to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called, and please withhold your applause until all the names are read. From your right is Elimelech Rahm of IBA Israel TV. Bob Adams, freelance journalist. Eugene Methvin of the Reader's Digest. Itamar Rabinovich of Ambassador of Israel. Frank Okafor, Washington Bureau Chief of the Milwaukee Journal and a past president of the National Press Club. Mrs. Susie Yvonne, wife of our speaker. Skipping over our speaker for a moment, we have Christy Wise, freelance journalist and chairwoman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Stephen Joel Trachtenberg, president of the George Washington University. Doris Margolis of Editorial Associates and the member of the club's Speakers Committee who organized today's luncheon. John Fogarty, Kiplinger Washington Editors and the past president of the club. John Sodergren of Defense Week. And Jonathan Kapeloff of Washington Jewish Week. Also, I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Sherry Burton, Melanie Abdow-Dermott, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. Now, today, we are honored to have with us Ambassador Abba Eban, a man whose career not only spans, but has left an indelible mark on many of the great events of the past half century. The Times of London perhaps put it most eloquently in terming him the most brilliant diplomatist of the second half of the 20th century. I don't know if anybody's asked Henry Kissinger about that, but he probably agrees too. Ambassador Eban may hold some kind of record for speaking here at the club. He came for the first time on the 21st of November, 1950. I hate to tell you how old I was at that time, when he was Israel's brand new ambassador to the United States. And at that time, he proclaimed that peace in the Middle East was right around the corner. It has been a long walk to that corner, Mr. Ambassador, but you have been along with us every step of the way. This is your ninth time speaking here, and the prospects for peace have never been better. Born in South Africa and educated in England to become a professor at Cambridge University, Mr. Eban caught his first glimpse of Palestine as a British captain during World War II, assigned to Jerusalem. He wrote, "The intoxicating scent of orange blossoms from the dark green citrus orchards and the Hebrew signpost at the station were my first indication of being in the Zionist domain. 4 years later, he walked into a British military base in Jerusalem, handed in his military papers, and walked over to the Jewish agency to sign up as an official. The Cambridge scholar, a classicist who loved words and had studied Arabic and Persian, rose to become the Jewish state's main expositor to the outside world, the Washington Post wrote. He remained at the center of Israeli diplomacy for three decades, all the way from the United Nations debate on the partition of Palestine to the defeat of the Labor Party in 1977. Since then, he has still been the expositor of the Jewish experience through his books and public television series. And during this past year, Ambassador Even has served as the first Shapiro Professor of International Affairs at the George Washington University. He comes to us at a crucial moment in Israeli history. The months following the historic signing of the peace accords between Israel and the PLO have been tumultuous for both sides. But so far, the leaders have not favored on the path toward fulfilling those accords. Mr. Even, we are counting on you to tell us where the pitfalls lie and what the prospects are for a permanent peace that you promised 43 years ago was right around the corner. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a warm press club welcome for Mr. Abba Even. Thank you very much.
I'm very grateful to you, Mr. Chairman, for what you have said. You have achieved generosity without any marked departure from precision. The only objective things written about me have been in introductions by successive chairmen and, of course, in my autobiography. Autobiography is an excellent device for telling the truth about other people. But sometimes they do reveal something about oneself. I greatly appreciate the hospitality of this club because as ambassador to Washington some decades ago, I once held the record for frequency of appearance at this podium. Now that distinction was attested by the proliferation in my closets of multitudes of the ties which you were accustomed to present to your speakers. When you thought that it was time for meetings to end. I understand that that practice ceased when the Indian Prime Minister, Mr. Nehru, addressed your luncheon. He was clad in a black tunic which was buttoned right up to his neck, and suddenly ties appeared to be monstrously irrelevant. I remember that he gave the tie a very baleful look, wondering to what useful purpose such an article could possibly be applied. The same kind of look as I saw Winston Churchill cast when a glass of water was unwisely put on the podium. Your generosity toward diplomats should not be allowed to obscure the basic truth, Mr. Chairman, that there is an intrinsic built-in conflict between the media and diplomacy. What one seeks to conceal, the other wishes to expose. The entry of the media into every stage of the negotiating process changes the whole spirit and nature of the diplomatic system. The modern negotiator cannot escape the duality of his role. He must transact business simultaneously with his negotiating partner and with his own public opinion. The clock can never be put back to the era in which at least the early and intermediate stages of negotiation were sheltered from the domestic constituencies of the negotiating parties. Of course, the patron saint of all of this was Woodrow Wilson. Open covenants openly arrived at, after which there shall be no private understandings of any kind, but diplomacy shall proceed always in the public view, in the light of the universal interests of mankind. Well, having promulgated this tumultuous advice, President Wilson locked himself into a room with three other leaders in the most secretive and conspiratorial conference that had at that time ever been held. Woodrow Wilson, like many great men in history, lived in such close intimacy with his own conscience that any transitory conflict between them could always be rapidly resolved. The weakness of the open covenant theory is that one party gets wind of the concessions made by his own side without or before simultaneous knowledge of the corresponding concession received or expected from the other side. I can tell you that all hell would have broken loose at the time of the Egyptian-Israeli negotiation if Israelis had heard of Prime Minister Begin's renunciation of all Sinai without learning that Sadat had shatteringly undermined the Arab doctrine, denying Israel's legitimacy. The same thing would have happened in Egypt if the Arab world had been told of Egypt reneging on what was then sacred Arab doctrine about Israel's non-existence without also hearing of his success in recovering his territory and his honor. So at the risk of not being invited here again, I must tell you that I did rejoice at President Carter's success in keeping the TV and newspaper pundits below in the plane while he negotiated with Israel and Egypt on the lofty heights of the Maryland Hills. My ancestor Moses would not have got his Decalogue adopted if the turbulent folk below had known about the attractive options which they were henceforward forbidden to attempt. Now, about the my own participation in the public debate on the current peace process really began on the memorable 13th of September, when I crossed the White House lawn and was intercepted by the NBC representative, Tom Brokaw, who said that there was very little time. There was only time really for one question and a brief answer. And his question was, have you read Arafat's last speech? And my answer was, I hope so. It is the Middle East peace process in which this conflict between the need for public explanation and the exigencies of private concession is greatest. You cannot get agreements without compromise. Compromise means that you accept today what you swore a few months ago that you would never accept. This is a salutary exercise, but it's not something that political leaders like to be photographed doing. Concession. To your negotiating partner, you say that the concession that you offer him is so painful that you don't understand your ability to make it. Meanwhile, you whisper to your anxious domestic constituency that your concession is really not of great value, but your own genius and your partner's gullibility have given it a certain weight. Now, what is the problem? The problem is that the wind carries your words in both directions, and your constituency and your negotiating partner hear what is meant each to the other. But let me at this stage make a proclamation really of faith, I believe of rational belief about this process. The decision of the Israeli electorate to establish a government committed to innovation, compromise and change was a splendid event. Even before the implementation of any agreement, the Israeli-Palestinian Accord has led to a drastic reinforcement of central Israeli interests. I'm not here to tell you that there will be paradise if the peace process succeeds. I will say that there will be an inferno of violence and despair if it were allowed to fail. Think, if you will, of the extraordinary convergence of ostensibly disconnected events that were necessary for this window to open. The Desert War, incidentally, not all of these events were the product of Israeli initiative, but their convergence was almost miraculous. The Desert War undermined the power and the malice of our implacable enemy. The collapse of the Soviet Empire suddenly transferred the full brunt and gigantic weight of the Soviet Union from the negative side of the scale of peace to the positive side of the scale of peace. No longer the Soviet Union, the spoiler, the saboteur of peace, the inciter against Israel, the trainer of terrorism, but the Soviet Union, if you please, as a sponsor together with the United States of the peace process, putting up Israel's flags in most of the republics, including the Muslim republics of the former Soviet Union. Syria. The greatest effect of the Soviet collapse was in Syria. Remember, if you will, that Syria has never conceived the idea of fighting against Israel, except in three conditions. One of them was the condition that Egypt should be fighting against Israel at one and the same time. Say what you like about President Hafez al-Assad. He is a realist, and he understands the valor of which discretion is the better part, and how comforting it must be to fight against Israel from the north if you know that an even stronger Arab power is attacking us from the south. The second condition was Soviet armaments and a Soviet safety net, which would, whenever Syria got itself into trouble on the battlefield, save it from ultimate defeat, certainly save it from Israel proceeding towards Damascus. The third condition was to have a friendly and fraternal Iraqi army at its side. None of these conditions now exists. Syria cannot rely on Iraqi protection, on an Egyptian alliance, or on a Soviet safety net. Therefore, to believe that Sadat might now be really ready for peace, it isn't necessary to believe in his virtue. It is necessary only to believe in his realism. The fact that Syria is ready to negotiate peace is itself the kind of event that would not have been expected by serious people even a year or two ago. The existence of negotiation does not, of course, prove the existence of an agreement or of a solution. And yet it is not incredible that Syria should be capable of reaching a peace agreement with Israel, precisely because we are not dealing here with virtue and conscience, but with reciprocal self-interest. Each negotiating partner has not only something to demand, but something to offer in the context of a peace settlement. More international agreements are reached through the absence of viable alternatives than through the merit of proposed solutions. Jordan is not the Jordan that some of us recollected with dismay during the Desert War. There has been drafted already in a very advanced stage of formulation the kind of vision of a Jordanian-Israeli peace. Jordan is not the most important of the Arab states, but it is in the Jordanian-Israeli relationship that there seem to be most prospects of concrete regional development projects. Is it not ridiculous that there should be two ports, one in Eilat and one in Aqaba, a few kilometers apart? Why not a joint port authority? Is it not foolish that we and the Jordanians should be engaged all of these years in preventing the other from utilizing the pharmaceutical resources of the Dead Sea, still amongst the most important pharmaceutical resources in the world? Why not a joint Dead Sea authority? Why not cooperation on tourism? What if those people in search of the roots of Western civilization could travel from the holy city of Jerusalem across the Jordan to Petra, the seat of the ancient Nabataean civilization, and thence to Egypt, especially Upper Egypt, to witness the glories of the Pharaonic regimes? Why not 20 million tourists to our region instead of the meager 2 or 3 million that now reach us? Egyptians change also because Egypt is no longer rather shamefacedly avoiding contact, but is an active catalytic agent in the peace process. In fact, meriting and deserving much more praise for its role in overcoming crises than the media have accorded to it. And that is because Egypt is itself an exemplar. The Egyptian-Israeli relationship is a success story, especially in terms of logistic security. Israel, while in possession and control of Sinai, meant 3,000 Israeli dead. 3,000 in the Six-Day War, in the War of Attrition, and in the Yom Kippur War. And war was always inevitable. Now, under the monitored peace treaty, our losses are zero, and war is almost inconceivable. To prefer the previous situation to the present one would mean to prefer death and war to peace and life, and it is Egypt's ability to present that spectacle that gives such weight to its intervention. Above everything else, a change in the Palestinian outlook. It is progress towards self-understanding. The mainstream Palestinians understand the overwhelming weakness to which their leaders have maneuvered them, although they don't always acknowledge that source of their weakness. Their rhetoric of bombastic threat is typical of those who lack power. I would suggest to you, therefore, not to regard that as decisive, although it is certainly deplorable. What is decisive is what is happening on the ground. And on the ground, I believe that the media should give the peace process a longer chance. 24 hours had not elapsed after the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza before the newspapers were writing that everything in Gaza is chaotic. Well, why should it not be chaotic? What does anybody expect? Coexisting in Gaza, you have the following elements. You have the Israeli Defense Forces. You have the PLO. You have the Hamas terrorist organization. And you have, amongst Israeli settlers, some who do not regard the attainment of a compromise peace as their most passionate wish. Now, are these the ingredients for an immediate transition to smooth administrative arrangements? I can only tell you that our own Prime Minister, Mr. Yitzhak Rabin, yesterday, or the day before, expressed satisfaction with the way in which the Palestinian police force is working. The number of occasions on which I have heard my Prime Minister express satisfaction at something is not unlimited. And if even his skeptical character finds this satisfaction, I suggest it is much more important than anything else, because it is the manner in which order is maintained in the evacuated area that the real testing ground will come. Well, change also in the United States, which I, resting on your president's statement the other day, seems to mean that the United States will not only offer yellow pads and meeting rooms, but will also accept a catalytic role, some kind of mediatory role. There's a tendency to believe that because of the remarkable exploits in Oslo, that mediation is now ruled out and only direct confrontation is feasible. I do not believe this. Mediation is not ruled out. Behind the mediatory idea are the three great successes in the Arab-Israeli relationship, the tower above all others. There is the armistice agreement, the four agreements in 1949, which crystallized situations, positions, and even territorial frameworks, which have lasted ever since. There are the disengagement agreements negotiated by Henry Kissinger, which didn't bring peace, but which did avoid what would otherwise have been an almost certain renewal of war. And there is the appearance of the mediatory role of President Carter at Camp David. Now, this is because a trusted third party can sometimes make proposals or put forward ideas which neither of the litigant parties can suggest himself or accept from his adversary. And it is in relations with Syria and also to Saudi Arabia, in which there's been a retreat of a certain degree in their position. It is here that the United States could play a very determinant role if it were willing to enter this phase. So here is Israel, firstly, utterly predominant in strategic security, vastly outstanding against any forces that could rationally be brought to assail it, and in a stage of diplomatic success that was unbelievable a year or two ago. Instead of maintaining relations with a meager 40 countries, there are now 120 nations or more which maintain or seek to maintain relations with Israel, including the giants of the third world, India and China, including most of the republics, including the Muslim republics of the former Soviet Union. Israeli isolation is ended, and Israel, as a result of its central part in the peace process, basks in the kind of international approval that has even reached some of the centers of traditional alienation. Well, it's even reached the United Nations. The United Nations is not an instrument for solving conflicts, it is an arena for waging them. And in that great engagement, the fact that it's possible to have joint resolutions adopted with massive majorities on the sponsorship of Israel and the PLO, this is one signal of what has occurred. I also refer to the fact that this is the age of what I've called strange encounters. De Klerk and Mandela, Arafat and Rabin, for a brief moment, the prime ministers of Ireland and the United Kingdom discussing the legitimation of the IRA. Israel, the country of the Jews, and the Vatican, the source of so many of the expulsions and theological incitements, and the Crusades, and the ghetto, now in this new alignment of reconciliation. And this is because, amongst other things, Israel has awakened from illusion. The Israeli consensus no longer believes that it is possible for one nation to rule another without consent. Why should we believe in such a possibility? It was not possible for Britain in India, or for France in Algeria, or for Holland in Indonesia, or for Belgium in Rwanda or in Congo, or for the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, or for that matter for the United States in Vietnam, or for the South African white population and the South African black population. This is a liberating age, an age that favors secessions in which self-determination is celebrating what might perhaps be an exaggerated but nonetheless very real victory. And in that kind of a world, what would be gained by our maintenance of Gaza or of the other areas, apart from security needs in other parts of the territory? Why should we believe that that is possible? Israelis do not believe that that is feasible. In fact, the West Bank and Gaza, if they were to remain under their previous regime, would present the picture of the most explosive and incoherent societies on the world map, because the relations between the two nations lacks the saving grace of equality, the saving grace of equality which alone enables nations to live together, either in separate jurisdictions, side by side, or within the same context of citizenship. I believe then that it's far too early to react hypochondriacally to every setback. There are going to be many of them. Doors will be slammed and later opened. And yet the reciprocal self-interest of the negotiating parties is so profound that I doubt whether they will agree on either side to give up this effort. And what we are entitled to ask from the friends of peace, including Israel's friends in the world, is not to lose faith in this endeavor. I wish we could count on our kinsmen and on our supporters in the United States to give the peace effort at least the same exemplary solidarity that they have always given when Israel is faced by the prospect of war. And if, as a result, the area of our jurisdiction seems to be a little much smaller, first of all, the jurisdiction was not much worth having in Gaza. And secondly, it is not the size of our jurisdiction, but the resilience and the nature of our economic and social activity and their repercussions in the world that will count. I remember when our first president, the illustrious Chaim Weizmann, was elected. For reasons which I never understood, Burma became extremely excited, and they wanted to reward our president with a gift. And the gift was to be an Indian elephant of enormous size and weight. And President Weizmann asked me, his very young and junior associate, to draft a courteous letter saying that in his native village in Russia, there used to be a proverb amongst the Jewish farmers: never accept a present that eats. So if people dream of the past extension of territory, think of what it eats and of what it erodes, and in what sense it diminishes a country's basic values. And one Israeli gain from the whole process is the ability for Israel to redeem its democratic identity, to redeem its democratic identity by bringing the neighboring people into a realm of consent. My concluding words are those which I spoke to the graduates and the participants of the courses that I gave in the George Washington University. International rivalries may never be solved, but they can be kept in restraint. War prevented is a kind of peace, perhaps the only kind of peace that nations will ever know. This may sound unambitious and unattractively sober in comparison with messianic yearnings for perfect peace, which illuminate many of the noblest chapters of history. But diplomats scarred by experience can only inhabit a middle ground between excessive skepticism and exaggerated hope. In conclusion, I can only say in defense of the diplomatic communities, both in the faculties and in the international field, diplomacy must be judged by what it prevents and not only by what it creates. Much of it is a holding action designed to avoid explosion until the unifying forces of history take us all into their embrace. Thank you.
That was excellent, excellent. And we'll get right to the questions because there are many. The first questioner wants to know, in dealing with the PLO, is Rabin too cautious or is Peres too gullible?
I'd like to say, first of all, there seems to have been some misunderstanding because the organizers of this meeting asked me if I objected to questions. I said, no, why should I object to questions? I now find that you want answers as well. Completely different situation. I do not really believe very much in anything but differences of temperament between the two leaders who are carrying Israel's banner. First of all, let me say that the one thing they have in common, they have survived 12 attempts at passing resolutions of non-confidence. In other words, Israel is sustained by an accumulation of votes of confidence by Parliament, which I think ought to have been noticed more. In addition, we have public opinion polls in our country. Now, one of your presidents, President Johnson, once had a paternal attitude towards me, and he once said to me, I do advise you, sir, always keep your ear glued to the ground. When I came back after attempting this exercise, and And I wanted to say to him that if you keep your ear constantly glued to the ground, you will lack two important qualities: elegance of posture and flexibility of movement. In other words, this is sustained by a large body of opinion. I don't believe in this distinction, and I certainly do not think it productive to have op-ed writers, whether in Washington or anywhere else, engage in offensive reactions to one or other of our leaders. I believe that the United States is vitally involved with us in this venture. I do not know of any differences of emphasis. And I think that Americans of all faiths should understand that here we have a central foreign policy interest of Israel and the United States together. Now, if there are these differences of expression, some of them may be deliberate and others may be inadvertent. I remember the same President Johnson saying to me once, "We've had a friendly talk, but if you go and talk now to Dean Rusk and Clark Clifford, you'll find that they're as mad as hell about something." Well, and my own feeling was that these things are adjustable. I believe that the Israeli attitude in general and amongst the leadership, it isn't in a state of illusion. It isn't a sort of, nothing is full of rainbows. There's a full understanding of the complexity of this issue. There's a full willingness, I believe, to endure with greater patience and not ask questions immediately. I remember when an Italian prime minister came to Israel. In 5 minutes after his arrival, a press man asked, "Mr. Prime Minister, what are your impressions of Israel?" And he hadn't moved out of the plane. Don't ask these questions all the time. And I think that it's a very effective team, and that it could produce a very dramatic result.
Do you expect the PLO to live up to its agreement to amend the PLO constitution to delete the phrases calling for the destruction of Israel? If so, when? And why hasn't this occurred already?
You're already asking the kind of question that you should address to the PLO representative. And after all, these people are now available to American audiences. The rumor is that they propose to do this. If you ask me whether in the Israeli consciousness this is the central issue is what they do. The central issue is what they do and how they conduct themselves and whether they will preserve security, whether they will exist in Gaza and Jericho as has to some extent existed since the changes have been made. And meeting a country in direct negotiation and expressing a belief in its sovereignty and its independence, sometimes expressing the belief that it is we who have more sovereignty and independence than they, which between ourselves is not entirely inaccurate. I think that is really what counts. But yes, since they have promised to do this, I believe that the persuasive pressures upon them should not be abandoned.
This questioner says, given your remarks, is the Israeli lobby in the United States a detriment to the peace process? What would you ask of them at this crucial time?
I said something earlier on in another context about the valor of which discretion is the better part. No, I don't think that it's a question to be legitimately addressed to me. I would only say that what is called the Israeli lobby, and here I would widen that term to the support of Israel in terms of historic and spiritual kinship. That is a massive asset for Israel. And therefore, I would say of that lobby and of others, of all the institutes and organizations who are stressing this reciprocity and mutuality of interests, I believe that their support is fundamental and is basically positive for its influence, not only on Israel's welfare, but on the prospects of peace. Now, in general, I would say that Israel is receiving from American opinion in general, including from those specified here, a full measure of the devotion and support to which we think our mutual interests entitle us.
This questioner says the Syrian negotiating position seems to not have changed since September 1991, and now it has been revealed that negotiations will be conducted via a U.S. middleman instead of face-to-face. Are negotiations between Israel and Syria bogging down?
First of all, it is perhaps because of my own experience, almost miraculous that the negotiation is taking place. And what they are saying is not nonsense. It isn't yet anything acceptable to us. They're not disappearing into vague clouds about Israel's non-existence or talking about the origins or the culpability of the conflict. They are saying things which, incidentally, are not all that far from certain things that Israel was saying at a certain stage. On June the 19th, 1967, the Israeli government, of which I was a member, empowered and, in fact, required me to offer the Egyptian and Syrian governments peace treaties on the basis of the international boundaries. Now, the Syrians must learn, and the Palestinians especially, that there is a price to be paid for rejectionism. The Palestinians, for example, are no longer fighting for really what they want, but for what they can save. And what they can save is less than they could have saved if they had responded earlier on to the possibilities of peace. That is the negotiation. It's being ably conducted in this city by Ambassador Rabinovich. And both he and anybody concerned with Syria will have to understand that Syria is a very complex kind of reality, and that if the need for progress requires some intermediary view, there is no reason why Israel should reject that when it has brought Israel such extraordinary favorable results in 1949 and in 1974, and above everything else in 1967 and 1968. But I believe that time is not on the side of peace, and this should be the year for bringing the Syrian-Israeli dialogue to what I hope would be a successful close. If you ask me if anybody has changed, everybody's changed. If you say that the Syrian position is the same as it was, it isn't the same as it was, because they're now willing to negotiate, understanding that negotiation means that you have to somehow divide the gap between two parties. Let me tell you that the Israeli position isn't the same as it was a year or two ago. And proposals are known to Syria which do take account of their anxieties as well as, in a paramount way, of our security. Therefore, it's a hard and a tough negotiation with a hard and a tough partner. But if there is success, the results will be so spectacular, because I believe that then the repercussions will spread into Jordan and into Lebanon and probably into other hesitant Arab and Muslim countries as well. A great deal is at stake here, and therefore we ought to be ready and are ready to invest in it a certain degree of optimism and of patience as well. I'm not a pessimist. A pessimist is a person who, when faced by a choice between two evils, takes them both.
This questioner wants to know, how do you evaluate the following two contradictory ideas? One, Jews should live wherever they want to live, and two, Israeli settlers would do well to move out of the occupied territories.
Well, anybody who says that Jews should be free to live wherever they live, I think must face the question of principle. If we're talking of an area or a country, why not say that anybody can be free to live where he wants to live? I must tell you that isn't the case. That isn't the case in our region. And secondly, whatever is the consequence of freedom must, after all, be contingent on basic security. Let me give a concrete example. There is a synagogue in Jericho. I must tell you that I never heard of any interest by anybody in the synagogue in Jericho. Nobody had tried to repeat the technology which enabled trumpets to bring the walls crashing down. But all of a sudden, there are those who are interested in the Jericho synagogue, I'm afraid for the purpose of testing the ground, to put it in a delicate way. I think that there should be a matter of prudence. It's a very tense area. I believe that those who are in Israel, in certain parts, and also especially in the territories themselves, would be advised not only to assert their rights, but also to restrain their rights by the imperatives of prudence. I think there is in this country the folklore of a grave on which was inscribed, "Here lies John Jones, who exercised all his rights."
To what extent might the Israeli economy benefit from Arab states' demand for services Israel could supply, services such as civil and agricultural engineering consulting, should the calm of peace truly descend on the Middle East?
Well, that's an important question and not an abstract one, because the economic and financial leaders in Israel have already begun to explore what would happen to our region if the barriers of belligerency were abolished. It's an extraordinary picture. Some of them go so far as to say that we could anticipate in Israel the kind of fluorescence that has occurred in the newly industrialized economies on the Pacific Rim. All of them rate very highly indeed, both the rate and the steepness and the steep and the rapidity of economic advantages which would grow if these barriers were brought down. Even if there is one success, for example, such as proving the efficacy of the Israeli-Palestinian Memorandum of Understanding, or an additional success in relations with Jordan, and especially with Syria, I think you will see such an eruption of initiatives both by and toward Israel, that would totally change the picture. What is needed, however, is at least one or perhaps two more acts of agreement, similar and parallel to that which was signed in this city on the 13th of September. We're a very short way distant from the kind of response to economic opportunities that we had never envisaged before. And that's why the Israeli industrial and financial sources are amongst those who are most passionately and ardently in support of the peace process.
What do you see as the ultimate settlement of the status of Jerusalem?
The status of Jerusalem, first of all, you might be surprised if I say that it isn't really a problem, because a divided city is a problem. The natural condition of a city is to be united, and Jerusalem is united, and therefore to that extent it isn't a problem. What is not envisaged at all would be any what I would call secular division of Jerusalem into separate sovereignties. This does not mean to say that we do not acknowledge or have never acknowledged that which is special and particular in Jerusalem, namely the holy places and problems of access and pilgrimage. And an Israeli government in the mid-60s stated, for example, that it is not our ambition to exercise our governance over the mosques and in the area which is holy to Islam. I think the phrase that the Israeli government then used was that we do not claim exclusive jurisdiction or unilateral responsibility for the holy places of Islam. So that's on the positive side. On the negative side, Jerusalem has known many sovereignties. It has known the sovereignty of the Mamluks and the Byzantines and the Ottoman Turks and the United Kingdom and of Jordan. Well, it's now going to know the sovereignty of Israel. What's wrong with that? And that's what it's going to be, a united city under Israeli sovereignty.
This questioner says, you have spoken eloquently about diplomacy and changes in the Soviet Union and the Middle East. But we've seen the revival of ethnic hatreds in Europe and Africa. Has diplomacy failed? Are the hatreds so deep as to be hopeless?
Most of the world, and especially the diplomatic world, both in its academic and in its functional capacities, was obsessed for many years by the Cold War. This was the only source of understanding. This was the only context. And there are some people who are alleged to have some kind of nostalgic longing for the clarity of that position. You knew who your enemies were. You knew who your friends were. You could have gradations of your friends between the faithful and the less faithful. And there were the neutrals. Well, it's not like that. The trouble is this. The Cold War was so obsessive, so universal in its effects, dominated the literature on this subject to such an extent that so much of diplomatic literature has become obsolete almost overnight, which is an attractive idea for those of us who want to write books. Since that has happened, we failed to understand that the Cold War was the kind of lid on a seething cauldron under which there were fermenting and bubbling these noxious conflicts which had been suppressed, restrained, because no small country wanted to start something which might lead to a nuclear war, which have now broken through. And therefore, there's not going to be a new order. We'll have to live with what I have called the new disorder. Because in a sense, the Cold War had a sort of stabilizing effect, leading to the tendency to ignore other conflicts and antagonisms, which do not and should not have the vast explosive potential of nuclear confrontation, but which are pretty horrible in themselves. That's why we see Rwanda and we see Bosnia, we see Somalia. But if you ask, is there an easy way out of all of this? There is not an easy way out of this. Certainly not for small countries such as my own, not even for great powers. I think the world is not going to inherit a new utopia such as statesmen sometimes see, usually after they've had some kind of ecstatic success, like the Desert War, or a traumatic failure, like the situation in the Bosnian area. I think we have got to live, as I suggested, it's wrong to send young people into the world and give them illusions about a kind of new utopia, certainly not for Israel. Utopia, for one thing, is a country without boundaries. And in Plato's Republic had no foreign policy. The trouble with utopia that against our own country is that utopia has no boundaries and no neighbors. Israel has boundaries and has neighbors. I, as a Jew, have never had problems with the Christian doctrine that you should love your neighbors and also love your enemies, because usually they're the same people.
Can the United Nations be an effective world police force?
The United Nations has gone through many phases. The first phase was what I call the phase of illusion. The great men of the world, who seem to dominate the international structure, sat in Yalta. There they were, Roosevelt and Churchill and Stalin, and drew up the blueprint of an international organization which would perpetuate their own domination. In other words, there would be five powers who would run the world, and they would have military contingents. And until 1943, these bemedaled generals used to meet every month and disperse without reaching a conclusion. They were to be able to enforce anti-aggression. They were to suppress aggression. Well, that collapsed. And it collapsed for the following reason. There is not a sense of world community which would give the United Nations the kind of passionate devotion that nations give to their own flag. There is not a sense of world community such as this. When your astronauts reach the moon, what they plant there is the flag of the United States and not the flag of planet Earth. And that's a strange thing that's happened. Social history tells of the constant expansion of the idea of community from the family to the tribe, from the tribe to the village, from the village to the city, from the city to the nation state. Somehow it's got stuck. And people do not give to anything above the nation state the kind of devotion and solidarity which would be needed for an international organization to operate in what is called as a force, as a police force, and something that would be obeyed. No, I think not. I think we have to be satisfied with lesser palliatives. One of them suggested recently by Brian Urquhart, who was the Deputy Secretary General until recently. He thought that since nation states are not going to give discretion to their armies to operate on matters which are not of national interest, he suggested a voluntary force at the disposal of the Secretary General of the United Nations, which would be called into action in such crises as have existed, especially in small countries. Even here, I think that Brian Urquhart doesn't really believe that this is going to happen soon, because, as I've said, any voluntary organization operating without the blessing of international institutions is going to be very hesitant indeed. At least that is a feasible idea. It is not as feasible as the idea of the United Nations having a police force. If it's a police force, let me say frankly, it'll have to have a large American component. Is the American people now in the mood to put its own citizens at peril for interests that cannot be described as national interests of the United States? You know the answer to that better than I do, but I'm certain we both have the same answer.
Well, we are about out of time. Before we finish here, I'd like certainly, and before I ask the last question, I'd like to present you with a certificate of appreciation. You probably have enough now to wallpaper your house with those. And we gave up giving out the ties a while back because we have so many women speakers. Now we give these mugs. They're wonderful things, and you can stick all your ties in them.
Thank you very much. Thank
you. Just a reminder that audio and video tapes and transcripts are available by calling 1-800-500-9911. And now, the last question. Could you please tell us maybe the mood and the atmosphere that was at the United Nations on the day that the vote was taken to create Israel in 1948?
1948, there was no vote to create Israel because Israel created itself in a kind of eruption of voluntary action. What there was before was a resolution calling for the recognition of Israel's right to establish a state, and then more substantively the vote on the 11th of May 1949, of which I remember the atmosphere very well because this was our admission to the United Nations, which meant also our admission to all the 35 international agencies. And all I remember the feeling in my hands of the rope with which I put that flag on the flagpole, knowing that in that moment the status of the Jewish people in history was irreversibly changed. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Internet Town Hall, a production of the Internet Multicasting Service in association with the National Press Club. You may copy this file and change the encoding format, but may not resell the contents or make a derivative work. Support for the Internet Town Hall comes from Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Additional support is provided by HarperCollins and Persoft. Network connectivity is provided by UUNET Technologies and MFS DataNet. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier, to the Global Village.